We're recording now.
Today is November 19th, 2005. The time is approximately 11:50 in the morning. We're at the Cook County Court Building at the Daly Center, and we're conducting part two of our interview with the Honorable Judge Jesse Reyes. Thank you, Judge, for agreeing to be in the second part of the interview.
My pleasure. I am enjoying it.
You graduated from law school, and what was the area of law that you began practicing?
Well, the area I went into after graduating from law school was litigation. And I realized in law school that I liked to become a litigator. So I started out with a firm that I was clerking with Kenneth Gore and Limited. It was mostly a personal injury workers' comp firm. It was a small firm. There wasn't that many people in the office. It was Ken. He was the head person in the office, and then myself and a couple other attorneys. And we're all relatively out of school. I mean, we're maybe like 2-3 years out of school. And other associate that had a few more years of experience on us, after I passed the bar, that he went on and went to work somewhere else. So it was a plaintiff's firm, and it was a very interesting experience. I was able to bring in business, which was profitable for everybody. But on the other hand, we were not trying cases, and I wanted to try cases. Ken's philosophy was if he could settle the case, it's worth more for the client and for everybody involved to settle the case. Being a young lawyer right out of law school, anxious to try cases, you want to try everything. So, in retrospect, I understand his philosophy and see, from his viewpoint, But at that point in my life, I wanted to try cases. So after about a year in Kenneth Gore's office, I moved on and went to the city of Chicago. And I worked in the city of Chicago torts division, I enjoyed my years there. It was a very rewarding experience. I got to try many cases to the jury. Both in state and federal court, and they're all civil litigation cases.
Involving what kinds of litigation?
Well, it was a variety of different type of issues, but mostly personal injury. The city at that time had also some medical centers, so some of them involved some issues with regards to medical malpractice. But not that many of them. Paramedics, negligence, which was, when I was there, was starting to become a major issue that a lot of the plaintiff's firms were trying to litigate against the city. So I would say, police, we represent the police officers, the paramedics, various departments. Nothing with regards to civil rights. It was all mostly personal injury. It was mostly wrongful death type of cases, but I got to do what I wanted, which was try cases in front of a jury, and unfortunately I was very very fortunate in having a opportunity to see some very good judges and some very good lawyers try cases and hear cases. The judges hear cases. So it was a great experience for me. I love doing it. I also think I got my appreciation of what a judge should be, or how a judge should be on the bench, and how a courtroom should be. You could kind of say that I came in the profession and in terms of litigation at a time when it was still old school, and everything was very proper and very professional, and you always had the proper decorum in the courtroom, and that's the way I now, as a judge, like to run my courtroom with that same type of proper decorum and professionalism. And so, from the standpoint of just being able to be in a courtroom sometimes. When I was a young lawyer at the city, it was a great experience. We got to see some very good judges on the bench.
Could you elaborate on that? What makes a good judge?
And part of the idea of the proper decorum.
Okay. I think for me, what made a good judge is someone that was a good listener.
Okay.
That was very attentive and listened to both sides. And then after having had an opportunity to listen to both sides, then would make a ruling on whatever the issue was. With regards to proper decorum, I think respect is the key word. Having respect for the judge, for the courtroom, for each other as advocates. My view is that, you know, I, as a judge, represent an institution. The courtroom represents an institution and our way of life. And the people that are in those courtrooms also represent the system as advocates. It's a long tradition. And it's important for the public to understand that that everything is done in a proper and orderly manner. Quite frankly, a lot of times the reason why people cannot resolve their issues and end up in the courtroom is because there's emotions, there's feelings one way or another. So therefore, in a courtroom, everything should be objective and unbiased, and everybody proceed in an orderly, proper fashion, particularly in front of the public. I mean, I think it's important for the judge and for the lawyers to conduct themselves in a manner where, you know, the public can feel, at least at the end of the day, that justice was done and that it was done in a very professional manner.
Can you perhaps elaborate on one of your most significant experience, or something that really comes out at you as a very memorable experience in the courtroom when you were a trial lawyer?
When I was a trial lawyer? Something that happened in a courtroom that was memorable. Oh, wow, that's a hard one. I don't know if I could really single it out and say there was one specific event. But I think the opportunity to stand in front of 12 people and to present your client's position, for me, that was always a memorable moment. When I got to go up in front of 12 men and women and give a final closing argument in a case, I took a lot of pride in that, because I mean that's the ultimate in terms of, you know, what our system of justice is. It's, you know, the people are going to decide this case one way or another, and you know, I am the one that is at that point in time on behalf of my client presenting what I feel are the facts that they need to really take into consideration, and the evidence that has been submitted for them to take into consideration, and, you know, basically hand it over on a tray and say, this is for you to decide. And I think that after it's all over, then you make your decision. I used to always end my closing remarks with a phrase that may sound a little hokey, but I really believed in a lot, and I always made sure that it was part of my closing, because I really felt that that was what epitomized the entire process, and that was that in a court of law there are no winners or losers, there are only those who receive justice. And then I would finish by saying, and justice in this case dictates that you return a verdict in favor of my client. And I really did feel that that was the truth. That, you know, in a court of law, when people come in to advocate their issues, there are no real winners or losers. It's just the one that receives justice. And that's what the process is supposed to do. It's supposed to deliver justice.
Have things in the lapse between when you were trying the beginning and then once you become a judge, how have things changed for litigators?
How have they changed? Well, I don't know if they've changed from the perspective of that the process is different. I think, unfortunately, some of what is going on in popular media gives people the wrong impression of what happens in courtrooms.
Such as, like, the People's Court and using the court as entertainment, perhaps.
Right. Well, I don't want to name any specific programs, but I think that the current trend in the media is that of people being depicted as being scolded and yelled at, as people shouting at each other, and that's not what happens in reality. It's not a contest, and modern or current media, it's about winning and losing, regardless of whether there's justice being delivered or not. It's about who's going to win and who's going to lose. And if you ever watch those programs, you know, they'll say, well, we're going to speak to today's winner. Then, you know, there are no winners.
And this idea also of the two-minute trial, almost like the five-minute fast quick justice, and then next, you know.
Right. And there are rare circumstances where you have those little sound bites in reality. I mean, that's all it is. They just show these little sound bites. And so I think that unfortunately has given the public the wrong image of the system of justice, and a very slanted image, I should say, because again, it's about dramatics. It's about the sound bites. It's about, you know, who's going to win here and who's going to lose. I was at a conference not too long ago, and one of the speakers mentioned that if you have cable, you could literally, for about 6 hours, click one channel after another in succession and watch 6 hours of courtroom TV, and a lot of it, it's all, you know, dramatized. And I'm not talking about the courtroom TVs where there's actually a courtroom, I mean, where there's actually a camera in a courtroom where a real trial is taking place. We don't have that here in Illinois yet, so that's not what I'm referring to, but these other, you know, shows where, you know, this dramatic soundbite type of scenario takes place, and that's, you know, you can watch 6 hours a day. I mean, I can't imagine watching. I mean, I don't watch that much television as it is, but rarely do I ever watch, you know, those type of programs. I remember when I was younger in L.A. Law, I think it was, came out, and I watched a few moments of it. Now, again, you know, it's a drama. And it was a trial, and you know, this lawyer is going on, and he's at the cross examination. He's, you know, he's hammering this witness, and he's, you know, getting away with things that you would never really be able to get away with in real life. And I found myself almost like I wanted to scream at the television, going like, "That's not what happens. That's not how it is." And then I never watched the program after that. And, I mean, it's just not, you know, not based on any type of reality. And unfortunately, you know, I mean, I have the perspective of having been there and done it, to know that that's not what it's like. But someone who has never been in that type of situation or is going to be going there for the very first time and they've seen these type of programs, that's what they're going to be left with in terms of impressions. You know, that's what they think the courtroom is going to be like. And, you know, it's probably a shock when all of a sudden they realize it's not like that. So I don't know if I answered your question.
Yeah.
If we can dovetail then into certain realities of the courtroom and into the cases that you began presiding when you were a judge, can you please tell us what year, approximately what period did you start presiding?
I went on the bench in 97, December of 97. So I've been on the bench about 8 years now, going on 8 years. And I had the good fortune, when I first came on the bench, I mentioned it to my superiors that, you know, I wanted to volunteer to travel around, which means, you know, I didn't just want to be assigned to one particular area, but they needed someone in a branch court, I'd be more than happy to do that, and they took me up on it. I had a very good experience the first 2 years of sitting in almost every branch court, actually in every branch court in the county. Then having also, I've had the opportunity to go to 26th Street and sit in a bond court. At that time, when I first came out, we used to have what was known as the night holiday bond court, and they had to sit in that. And I was in traffic. I was also assigned to domestic violence court, as well as in Markham, which is the 6th Municipal District. I was there for about a couple of years before I came back to the Daly Center. And now currently I'm in the Chancery Division doing the mortgage foreclosures and mechanics liens.
You talk about your superiors. It seems like there is, can you just briefly talk about that process of becoming a judge?
I'm an associate judge, and the process for an associate judge is that at certain points in time, the chief judge of the circuit court will open up what's called the list, and that means that people who are interested in becoming judges who want to run for associate judge position will apply. And I believe the year that I ran, which was in 97, it was the early part of 97, there was, 366 people that put their names in for 18 spots. And what the process then happens after the individuals who want to become judges put their names in, then you go before the Bar Association or Bar Associations to be evaluated. And if you receive a favorable evaluation, then, let's put it this way, after the Bar Associations evaluate you, then you get an opportunity to interview with the Chief Judge's Executive Committee. And at the time when I was running, the Chief Judge's Executive Committee was mostly made up of the presiding judges in the circuit court. So they interview you, they ask you a series of questions, and then ultimately, after they've interviewed everybody who wants to run for associate judge, they come out with what's known as the short list. And it's always twice the number of the spots they have. So in our class, it was 36. It was 36 of us who ran. And it's the most, let's say, exhilarating, intensive 2 weeks in your life, because you have to meet all the full circuit judges, and so it means you have to go to all the courthouses and all the courtrooms in the county to meet them. And not only the full circuit judges, there's some associate judges who are also very influential that can maybe help you, you want to make sure that you see them as well. But you want to make sure that you get your resume out to everybody and you meet them, even those that who know you. You have to make sure that you meet them. And then, you know, the ballot goes out, and then they vote for you. And if you're fortunate, to make it. Then you get sworn in a short amount of time after that, and then you go to what's known as judge school for a couple weeks. And that's a school that actually it has two components. There's the Cook County component, and then there's the state component. And basically what it is it's a program where judges and attorneys will lecture on various topics of the law. And it's pretty intensive as well. You're writing copious notes down, hoping that you remember everything, because at the time, you don't know where you're going to go. And the day when we finally got our assignments, it was a Friday, and we're all sitting in the, it was at a hotel in downtown, and we're in a banquet room. And because this is not only just the Cook County judges, but it was also judges from around the state that had just become judges, so we're all in the school together. And then one by one, we're getting phone calls to find out where our assignment is. Of course, everybody wants to know where we're. And, you know, the rule of thumb in Cook County is that, you know, you get first municipal, which means you can go to traffic or you can go anywhere, right? But all of us first started out in first municipal and in traffic. And it's a great place to start. It's a great place to start because at the time when I was there, we were at the old building over at 321, and they had this one room we referred to as the bullpen, and it's where everybody put their robes, it's where everybody ate their lunch, it's where everybody kept whatever files they had, it's where if you had to make a phone call, there was two phones, you know, it's where everybody went to go make their phone calls. And what was nice is around lunchtime or in the morning or maybe after the day, we would all sit around, and then, we would basically ask each other, you know, questions about how would you handle this, how would you handle that. So it was a great place to start and to be in.
And now, dovetailing, for example, into a specific realm, I guess, presiding of the subject of domestic violence.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit, I guess, in general terms. The experience of, because domestic violence is something that affects all cultural backgrounds, a diverse space of people. What is your experience presiding over such complex cases of domestic violence?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, people generally have this perception that it's just a poor person's courthouse, and it's not. Well, the period of time that I was there, for approximately about 2 years, on and off, you had some of the poorest individuals who were in front of you to some of the wealthiest. You had people that were, street cleaners, and I had some very prominent businessmen. Wealthy businessmen in front of me. So, you know, the spectrum is in terms of economic boundaries, it recognizes no boundaries. Domestic violence recognizes no boundaries, no cultural boundaries, no educational boundaries. I mean, it affects every walk of life, which is one of the sad parts about it, because, you know, it doesn't matter if you're educated with title on top of title on top of title and degrees, or you know, you just had basic grade school education, you could be affected by domestic violence. And it goes both ways. It's not just the women, but men are also affected by domestic violence.
And children.
Correct. You're absolutely correct. And children. And it was an experience for me. Because I remember one of the very first cases that I had was involving a situation where a judge had already, at one point in time, found the gentleman guilty and had sentenced them to the maximum that the statute allowed in that particular type of domestic violence case. And then something happened when he was getting out. He happened to talk to her, and they got together. Now, they hadn't been together for years. Okay, and they got back together again, and then in the interim, when they were back together, the domestic violence reignited, and he ended up putting her back in the hospital. And to me, it was like, how can something like this happen? I mean, this particular woman had not been with this man because of the judge's order for years. And then yet, you know, she went back. Well, they actually said they both went back together, the way I kind of saw it. Is they both went back together. And so I started looking into as much literature and law with regards to domestic violence as possible, because it was something that I found fascinating, in the sense as to how something like this occur. I mean, you know, I guess, you know, looking at it from the standpoint of never having seen it myself ever in my life, to now, you know, seeing these hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cases, it was just something that, you know, I wanted to get an understanding, because at least if I had an understanding, then I could understand what was the dynamics involved. Not so much to be geared towards one side or the other. That wasn't my purpose. My purpose was to understand what was the driving force, because it's both of them. It's not just one. So as a result of it, I became well versed in the area of domestic violence, and I then started becoming invited to go and speak, locally and then also around the country at various conferences regarding domestic violence. And it was a fascinating area. It was an area where it's not, even though it seems like maybe there's black and white, there's a lot of gray, and it's an area that unfortunately I think will be with us for a very long time. I think everyone involved, the judges, lawyers, social workers, are doing a great job in terms of getting an awareness out there. Just, you know, an awareness of what's going on and how to protect yourself in terms of your rights and so on and so forth. One of the things that happened when I was there, I had the good fortune of having heard the first victimless domestic violence case. And by victimless, what I mean is that the state's attorneys proceeded with their case without the victim testifying in the courtroom. And it was an interesting case, and it went up on appeal, and I was affirmed. But it was a case where the state, outside of the victim's testimony, had enough corroborating evidence that they felt that they could proceed with it, and I found that they did, and I ultimately found the defendant guilty, and then of course they appealed it. And it's one of those where, you know, as a judge, when you know you're going to get appealed, you're always kind of wondering, well, what's going to happen. But they came back with an affirmance, and so I was glad just from that standpoint, because it was something that, when I was looking at it in terms of the case law in the county and in the state, there was very little that I could really kind of go by in terms of victimless domestic violence cases. So I just made sure that I made a very good record, because I knew, the appellate court was going to be taking a look at this.
And approximately, what is the period that you preside over domestic violence? And then what happens after? I mean, you go from some presiding over very complex cases and becoming actually a very prominent voice in the U.S. and in Chicago. And what do you go on to do after domestic violence?
Okay, well, I don't know if I was a prominent voice. I was just, I guess, someone that they always kind of, invited to speak. But from there, I went out to Markham, the 6th Municipal District. And I was out there for a couple years also, in the 6th Municipal District. And my assignment, although I was given one room, I was also, because of my background with domestic violence, I was asked to, if needed, to hear domestic violence cases. But my call was mostly a misdemeanor court call. I had a variety of the villages and towns on the south end of the county. And that was interesting because you have, on the south end of the county, you have some of the poorest townships in the county, and you have some of the wealthiest. So you get a wide variety of cases and a wide variety of representation in terms of, you might have a public defender on one case, and then you might have a very prominent criminal lawyer representing someone on another case. So it was interesting from the standpoint as a trial judge, because you had it wasn't always the same thing day in and day out. It was always something different. And the way the misdemeanor courtroom was set up, it could be a variety of different things. I mean, it could be a simple assault case where someone is alleging, you know, an assault in a theater, because Tweeter Center's over there. So there's in the summertime, sometimes there's always, you know, fights after a concert. Or it could be one where I had a situation where a woman was being charged with stealing from a cable company. She was using cable services and not paying for it. And so it was a nice mixture, because you never knew from one day to the next what you were going to get, and they were all pretty pretty interesting.
What were the prevalent problems that affected communities? I'm thinking immigrant communities and poor communities.
I think violence was a prevalent problem that you would see with poorer communities. And I think in the immigrant communities, I think it's a lack of knowledge, lack of cultural understanding, lack of awareness of the laws. For example, you know, in our society, we frown upon physical use of force to discipline children. And in some other cultures, that's quite appropriate. And when someone's brought in front of you because they have been charged with physical abuse to a minor, they don't have an understanding of what they did wrong, because in their culture, this is quite appropriate.
But it's necessary at times, quote unquote.
Yeah, in their culture, they feel that, you know, if you're going to discipline a child, that's quite appropriate. So sometimes they don't have an understanding of why they're in front of a judge being charged with a crime. And you know, in the process, somehow or other, you have to try to make them aware of it. And again, as a judge, you can't advise them, but you try to make them aware of why they're being charged the way they're being charged. Because sometimes what I found interesting was throughout the process, you know, in terms of getting arrested and getting processed and, you know, meeting with the lawyers, both, you know, prosecution and defense, that aspect of it really was never ever fully explained. Now they're in front of you and they're still kind of looking like, what did I do? And, you know, so then you try to explain it. So,
and what was the most difficult case, for that matter, or cases that you remember during that period of time?
Difficult? Difficult in the sense of facts, or difficult in terms
perhaps,
of?
In terms of, it could be length, it could be, you know, complexity, it can be where you're recognizing so many external forces at play, and yet there's this need also to create a very objective environment to impart justice, as you have said?
I don't know if it was difficult.
The word is more complex.
Well, the one that I'm sort of thinking of was a case that involved neighbors. It was a neighbor dispute, and it was a cross-cultural type of situation. And there were siblings involved along with adults, and it was just a situation where throughout the trial, it was a lengthy trial, throughout the trial, these people didn't get it. They didn't get that at the end of the day, whatever happened, at the end of the trial, whatever my ruling was, that they were going to end up having to go back to their respective homes. And they were going to still have to deal with each other as neighbors. So for me, it was sort of like, don't you understand you're neighbors? So you should try to maybe get along like neighbors. I mean, you know. Because it was clear that neither one was going to move, which would have made life for everybody a lot easier, right? But in this one, it wasn't so much that it was difficult. It was just sort of maybe difficult for me to sit there and listen, in the sense that, you know, do they realize that they're going to have to go back home one day, and, you know, they're going to have to look at each other when they throw out the trash or when they're cutting the grass? And so I don't know if that answers your question or not, but
it's really interesting because I guess it goes back to this idea of really not knowing, sort of what. I mean, I guess there's this dichotomy. I mean, there's this really separation between like civil society and then what comes to the courtroom, and probably it delves back into, you know, our ideas of what the courtroom is, and you know how it plays out with the popular imagination. I guess into that, we wanted to ask you if you think that, how specifically you think our ideas of judges have changed over time.
Well, again, I think it goes back to perceptions, and I can't say specifically. But my view is, I think that our perception, our general perception of judges, is not what it used to be. And I think our general perception of not only judges, but the legal profession and of lawyers right now, it's not what it used to be. Now, you know, the fact is that I think what happens is that we go through these trends, you know, and you know, there's a period of time where, you know, judges and lawyers are held in high esteem, and then there's a period of time when they go back down and up. And right now, I think we're in that period of time where, you know, we're on a downswing, and I think it's gonna bounce back up, and we're gonna go back up. I take it back to what people see on a regular basis in the media. In the media, I mean, in just in general, radio, television, the movies, I'm lumping it all together. A lot of them derive their impressions of things from that. And because that's what they see. And then, you know, and unfortunately, sometimes I think that's what they end up, you know, believing, that's what happens. And then if it's not what a belief is, at least in terms of societal views, it's what a view is. For example, in the 50s, and I don't remember exactly when, there was a movie, it's called The Anatomy of a Murder. And the One thing a lot of people don't really know is that there's a courtroom scene, and the judge who plays the judge in it actually is a real judge. But it's a trial. It's a murder trial.
I've seen that movie.
Have you seen it?
Yeah.
All right. And you know, the advocates are strongly fighting for their clients, you know, both the prosecutor and defense. But yet, the way they do it is in a very professional, you know, manner. And the judge is depicted as a very, you know, wise professional who's doing his, you know, his job. But then, you know, years later, you get you know, these other movies that come out, and they depict the whole system completely different. I don't remember the name of the movie, but it's with Al Pacino. I think it's Justice for All. It's Al Pacino and Jack Warden, and there's this one scene where there's total chaos in the courtroom. Everybody's like yelling and screaming and everything else, and then the judge. No, it's not Serpico. The judge comes out. And he stands up, and you know, everybody's like, you know, there's no order, right? So all of a sudden, he just pulls up his robe on one side, he pulls out a gun, and he shoots it in a courtroom to get order. And I mean, it's you know, the sad part about it is that it's a drama. You know, it's not a comedy.
Yeah.
I mean, that part of it's, you know, sort of comedic, but the movie itself is supposed to be a drama. And to think that we went from this one here, and I think it's for Justice for All, I'm not sure, but we go from one viewpoint to another. That's a viewpoint that people see in the movies. This is a viewpoint that the general public will see, and I think that's damaging. Now, you know, there's others that argue that, you know, it's as a result of Watergate, you know, that, you know, after Watergate, we started questioning authority. We started maybe not having the same type of deferential respect for authority, and you know, it trickled all the way, you know, way down. I mean, the court system was involved in that process also. The legal system was involved in that process, and there was a lot of question about, you know, lawyers and judges with that process, and I think maybe that's what we're still seeing, is that viewpoint of lack of respect for authority and deference to authority. But I think this is a general view. I think that's what's going on in society today with regards to judges and lawyers.
In a deep sense, we come to really not understand at the end of the day, because we see judges, particularly in the way they're situated, even within the courtroom, in the center. So we see judges, in a sense, as, you know, having this very objective place. And then when we hear things like what happened to Judge Joan Lefkoe, you know, where suddenly we come to see them as human beings, you know. What is your opinion of that? And the shifts that are going on, particularly with this case, with Judge Joan Lefkoe?
Well, I think, again, I think that what it boils down to is a lack of respect again. Judge Lefkoe, as a person, represents the institution of the judiciary, and she presided over cases, and she made her decisions based on whatever facts and evidence that she had, and that is what her rulings were. Okay, now there's an appropriate means by which, if you're not satisfied with a judge's ruling, to proceed with. And, you know, this would occurrence with Judge Lefko and then the judge down in Atlanta. You know, is again, you know, where people decide that they individually they want to try to change the decision or change the process or not abide by the process. You know, and that's a throwback to another time when there was no law and order. And that I think this is where we've come full circle. I mean, in the sense that, okay, you don't respect law, you don't respect order, you don't respect authority. This is what's going to happen. And, you know, unfortunately, that is what, you know, what happened. And I think hopefully, you know, that will send a message to people that, you know, okay, so she's only one individual, but, you know, next could be you. It could be, you know, it could be your neighbor down the street. I mean, people don't want to abide by the rules. They want to abide by you know, authority. Okay, fine. Just get a gun and then, you know, shoot you. Then I'm done with the problem. But it's never going to end. And, you know, that's why we need to have courtrooms. We need to have the law and the order to maintain that within society, so people could feel protected, so they could feel that this is, whether I like it or not, this is where we resolve our differences. And if those differences are not resolved in my favor, so be it. But, you know, this is where we go. And, you know, it's not up to us to determine how it should be, but the process that we've all, as a society, decided this is the process. And whether we like it or not, at the end of the day, that's what the decision is. I have to accept that decision. And I think that's the unfortunate what happened with Judge Lefko. I think is an example of this trend of people saying, "Well, I don't like it the way it is. I'm going to try to change it."
Moving into another area.
Good.
One of the things that judges can talk about, and what are the things that judges cannot talk about while they are judges?
Well, the one thing that we cannot talk about, and the one thing I think sometimes maybe people do not understand, is pending cases. We cannot address anything with regarding a pending case. So you see sometimes press conferences after a trial or a hearing or a ruling, the lawyers will be out there speaking. You never see a judge, because even though the judge may have entered a ruling, that case may go up on appeal. So you can never speak about a pending case. That's just something that, you know, it's against our ethical rules to do. We cannot do that. So we can't speak to the media. We can never give our viewpoint in terms of how we felt about a particular ruling or a situation in the courtroom. And that's the unfortunate side of it, because sometimes when something happens in a courtroom in terms of a judge's ruling or certain circumstances, whatever, everybody gets the lawyer's point of view, but no one really, unfortunately, understands the judge's point of view. And you never really will. Because the judge is not going to speak about the case. You just can't do that.
Yeah, that's one of the points of this project, this oral history project, is, well, especially for retired judges, to look back on their cases and say, well, when I tried this case, I felt this way, and this is what I thought of it, and finally, like, have their point of view said. Mm-hmm. So this is why we're doing this. So another 20 years, when if you want to retire, you can come back and new people will come and interview you again, so you can get this all out.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
But, you know, what can we talk about? There's other things that we can talk about. We can talk about the law. We can talk about the process. We cannot give people advice. We cannot give people advice on pending cases. But we can address certain aspects of the law. Like, for example, you know, one of the things that we cannot do is, like, you know, right now we're going through the process of a new Supreme Court justice being appointed. So, you know, we can't speak on Supreme Court decisions, Supreme Court opinions, or the process. I mean, that's something that we cannot do, because we cannot get involved in partisan politics, which is another thing that we can't speak on. I mean, you know, you may have your preferences about some political party over another, or one political leader over another, but we can't speak on it. Also, in terms of soliciting funds, is another thing that we cannot do. And the downside of that is that, you know, a lot of times, you know, you might want to get involved in an organization because it's a worthwhile organization, but, you know, the fact that you're a judge, it'll be viewed as you're trying to use your office to have people, you know, give to this cause. So that's why, you know, we don't as judges. But, you know, one of the things that you can do is you can be proactive in certain areas. For example, when I first came on, and, you know, and I've been fortunate to work for two really good chief judges, Judge Donald O'Connell and Judge Tim Evans, because I have, in many regards, wanted to be proactive about some of the things that I think that we can address as judges, and that's come to my attention. And one of them is, for example, is when I was in traffic court, I realized that a lot of people that are only Spanish-speaking were not aware of their rights and were not aware of their consequences. I mean, I speak Spanish, but I never speak Spanish in the courtroom. I always use interpreter. And, you know, sometimes when the people come up and they're talking to the interpreter and then, you know, interpreter, you know, translates, you know, it would like, well, I don't understand what I did. I mean, you know, I just had a few beers, you know, what's wrong with that? You know, now, from where they came from, that may not be a violation of the law, but it's a violation here. So, became active in helping produce a Spanish-speaking DUI video. That was an educational video. We called it "Qué Precio Tiene La Vida," and it was about a young man who was married and had some children. Went to his brother's birthday party at his mom's house. Had a little too much to drink, and then we did the little thing too, where he was just drinking beer. His brother was drinking hard stuff, but he said, no, you know, he didn't want to get to that because, you know, he wanted to not get drunk, okay? But he did have a little too much beer, left. Sure enough, he's swerving over and he gets stopped. Now, what we did also in the videos, we showed that no one had any seatbelts on, which is another violation that happens a lot, and no one, he didn't have insurance. Okay, which is another violation, right? And then his name was Miguel Rodriguez, and what we did was we showed what happened to Miguel through the entire process. And I got a little cameo role in there. I played the judge. But we showed not only what happens to him, but what happens to everyone else around him. For example, you know, he wanted to get a judicial driving permit, so that means he had to tell his employer, which he wasn't too thrilled about. And then he was the only one that was able to drive in the family. He had a driver's license. His wife didn't drive, so that impacted his family. Because, well, how are they going to get the kids to school? How are they going to go shopping? You know, because, you know, now, you know, he's got this problem with the DUI. And, you know, and we also showed how it impacted his extended family, his mom, his brother, and so on and so forth. And then ultimately we ended up with statistics in terms of financially how much it ended up costing him, having to get the lawyer, you know, going to court, paying all the fines and fees. And then we finished it with statistics in terms of, you know, how many people have been killed as a result of drunk driving, and how many have been injured seriously as a result of drunk driving. So that was something that you know, I'm proud of, that I was involved in, that was through the circuit court. And the purpose of it was to educate the community. And We were able to get it out to a lot of community centers, a lot of community groups, and you know, they exhibited it. And even now, I mean, that was almost 8 years ago. I still, you know, people who said, "Oh, I saw you." You know, and I'm like, well, so, well, that's good. You know, so I hope you learn from it. So, so you know, those are, you know, that's like one of the things that, you know, as a judge, maybe you're not able to speak, but you're able to address something that, you know, in a way that you see. You know, fortunately, you know, we're constrained because, again, we can't raise funds, we can't, you know, participate in certain type of events. So it's kind of difficult sometimes when you do see a problem that you as a judge cannot do it because of our restraints in terms of the ethics. But, you know, sometimes you can find a way to get around it. Same thing with the domestic violence. You know, I went around speaking because I thought, well, maybe this would be a way to let people know what they can do, you know, if they're faced with this type of situation. And to also have an understanding of why, you know, people are the way they are in this situation. I was in Philadelphia, and one of the speakers was a former prosecutor who had tried a case where the woman was being accused of cheating on her husband, and she was not. And he finally confronted her, and they had children. And, I mean, he beat her so bad she ended up, she almost died. I mean, she was in the hospital, she almost died. And he went to talk to her in the hospital to testify, and she said no. Through the whole preparation of the case, she said no. She said no. And he finally put the case on, and they were successful, and he was found guilty. And after a trial, she went up to him, and she says, thank you. And, you know, he was like taken aback because, I mean, he had her understand she was not a good witness for him. You know, and then she came up to him and she said, thank you. This is, you know, I just couldn't be the bad guy because of our kids, which means that, you know, even though she almost got killed because of the children, she still had to maintain that relationship with his family as well. So, you know, sometimes people don't understand the other part of the dynamics that it's involved. That's why I always, you know, took on these opportunities to speak, because, again, like I said, it's not just black and white. There's a lot of gray out there. And, like, you know, with the Illinois Judges Association and the Circuit Court, we raise books. We give them out to schools, needy schools. And this year, we just actually raised over 3,000 books that we donated to a school on the west side, because the school is located in an area where they don't have a library, and you know, these children come from some families that can't even afford to buy a book.
It's interesting because you grew up telling us the way that you saw in your life with the mobile library that used to come every couple of weeks. And we would like to think that it's 2005 and that people have, children have access to these, to library at some point, and they still don't.
Right. There's you know, I mean, there's a lot more libraries in the city now than there was when I was growing up, but yeah, there are still areas where that's not available to them. There's still situations where maybe there are libraries, but some of these, you know, these children can't afford to buy books. So, you know, through this process, we're at least able to, you know, give them, you know, books, and we've been doing this now for about 4 years, you know, giving out books to, you know, to different schools.
That's very admirable.
Yeah, thanks. But so, you know, there are things that, you know, judges can do. Also through the Judges Association and the Circuit Court, we get involved in the principal for a day. And some of the judges go out to schools throughout the city, and, you know, they get to talk to the students. Because I think it's important that at least they see you. And, you know, whether you're a woman or a minority, you know, they see you, and they see you as a role model, and, you know, realize, you know, know, they did it, I could do it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Just to the last part of our interview, what would you sort of like to say at this point in your life as a judge? Main innovations, the main continuities of the court system in your experience. How do you foresee the court system in 50 years? I mean, when things become more complex.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one. And then two, if you have any questions that you would like to give us about any further details about this project.
Okay. So, I'm sorry, so where do I see the court system going in the future? The court system also has to keep up with society. And, you know, we're becoming very technological in our society. I mean, we're becoming reliant on so many pieces of electronic equipment in our everyday lives. And I think that's one place where I think, you know, we within the system have to try to keep pace. You know, in terms of information, being, you know, able to access information. I remember when I was when I was practicing, and if something came up where the judge needed some information, but it was in the court file, okay? Because a lot of times, you know, people don't realize, you know, judge doesn't just get off the bench and the court files are there. I mean, they're kept by the clerk, and you know, so sometimes when you need some information that's in the court file, you have to try to access it. And now, you know, the clerks, you know, have the computers where they can, you know, I can go to my clerk and just kind of bend over a little bit, and it says, you know, was there an appearance filed in this case? And he could just plug in the case and get that information. And in the past, you would have to get the court file from the clerk's office and manually send somebody down to get it and pull it up and bring it up. So so I don't know where technology is taking us, but that's something that I think that, you know, we have to be prepared to keep in pace with. I think also judges have to become more adept at the use of technology. And, you know, and some of them are, and some of them are not. You know, it's a generational thing. You know, the other day, my law clerk, we had a power outage with the computers, and the computers weren't working. I needed a case, and my law clerk said, "Well, Josh, how am I going to get the case when our computers are down?" I said, "Well, it's just, you know, you could go and get the book, and, you know, shepherdize it the old-fashioned way and, you know, find a case." Oh, yeah, that's a good idea. And, you know, when I was in law school, we learned to do research both on the internet and then also the old-fashioned way in terms of getting the book and shepherdizing it and again. So we don't want to lose that, but I think at the same time, we want to make sure we keep in pace with that. Beyond the technology, I mean, I think that we just have to maintain that sense of, you know, again, that we all represent an institution, and an institution is important and necessary in everyone's everyday life. You know, not everybody is going to try to take justice in their hand, hopefully not, but, you know, there's still the need for the system. There's still a need to get your disputes resolved, and we just have to make sure that we maintain the integrity of the system. I think that's important. And the world will always be changing. There's always going to be innovations that are going to create different changes in our lives, but we have to stay on the steady course that has gotten to us to where we're at. You know, I mean, terms of what kind of litigation matters come in front of a judge, those are going to be a lot different 20 years from now than, you know, what we're dealing with now. When I graduated from law school, a friend of mine gave me a book. It was a statute from the 30s, and I think it was 1939. And to think that all of the laws in the state of Illinois were contained in one book, okay? And now, when you look at the statute books that we have, okay, it's rows and rows, okay, of books. Okay, so, I mean, that's where we've gone from the 30s till now. But, I mean, just to think, you know, at one point in time in our society, it was all contained in one book. And I'm sure 20 years from now, it's probably going to be a lot larger. But, so, I don't know if I answered your question. Yeah, okay. I don't know, I kind of went off.
Do you have any questions for us in terms of what this project is, our experience interviewing you?
Yeah, I'd be interested in your experience in terms of interviewing. How much coffee did you have to drink before the interview? You know, so I wouldn't put you to sleep.
No, I'm not a big coffee drinker.
Neither do I.
But this for us is far surpasses what we expected.
Yeah.
From a judge, again, perhaps coming in from the outside in.
You're not as scary as we thought.
Oh, okay, good. All right.
Yeah, yeah. You're a real person.
Oh.
And it seems, at least my experience as a Mexican American, from a particular context, you always have this perception that, sort of like, you know, that you, not demonize, but you don't see, you know, you see like the law in like very sketchy terms because.
It seems like the why?
Because there's a lack of knowledge on this process. For example, the DUIs and growing up in a community that's done on Latino and always seeing that. You always think in terms of harassment and not in terms of using the state as a tool, which it's interesting because recently I went to see Rigoberta Menchú from Guatemala, and she was saying, you know what, it's... despite all of the things that have happened in our past, it seems to me that the state and the processes of the law is our best tool to first understand it and make it ours.
Mm-hmm.
Because really, I think that's one of the big problems in our society, is that we don't make that institution ours, you know, and
right.
We try to always separate ourselves and polarize ourselves from
right.
that. And I don't know what are the processes that make us do that, but and this is a great experience for me, really, you know. And also, I mean, you should role model, you know, but it doesn't necessarily have to be because you're a particular background.
Right. Well, yeah, I totally agree with them. I think you know, every migrant group that comes in, and you know, you could see it, you know, in terms of when you have the Irish, you know, you come in, you know, the Jewish, you know, they, you know, the first wave have to deal with the differences. You know, there's always differences. You know, there's cultural differences, there's legal differences, there's societal differences, and the first wave comes to deal with all these. They have to deal with all these differences.
I think it's saying we've had enough.
Okay, but then they adapt, and then they assimilate, and for some reason or other, I don't know why, but Latinos as a whole, and I mean as a whole because, you know, you could see individual groups, but as a whole, do not do that. I mean, they come in and they see the differences and they're like, okay, well, that's, you know, and that's it. And they don't want to try to adapt. They don't want to try to assimilate. They just want to maintain the difference. And I don't know. I mean, there's people, and I'm sure in your family, just like in my family, they've been here 20 years. And, you know, they refuse to want to speak the language or become citizens. They're like, what's with that?